This episode is dedicated to the memory of Bob Caporal.
I'm often accused of being a dreamer, but what people sometimes don't recognize is the dedication and perseverance it took to make my dreams reality.
Howard Baldwin started as a minor league ticket counter and steadily worked his way up, eventually becoming a founding owner in the World Hockey Association, or WHA. Known as the Rebel League, the WHA was responsible for forcing the NHL out of its medieval stupor. In time, the two leagues would come together. Howard would play a crucial role in overseeing that merger in ending hockey's seven-year war. But during those 7 years, the League of the Outlaws put out seven great seasons of hockey. Among the teams, none would match the sustained success of Howard's. Essentially born out of a bluff, his New England Whalers were crowned WHA champions in the league's inaugural season. The Avco World Trophy would be far from the last piece of championship hardware Howard hoisted above his head. But now we're getting ahead of ourselves, because the path to that historic night in 1973, the entire path Howard took, was anything but straightforward. Nothing would ever be given. Everything would have to be earned. And he knew it, too. It's a journey that's hard to believe, especially considering that just months prior to the puck dropping on that first season, the Whalers were nothing more than an idea, a dream. At the time, one of Boston's leading sports columnists wrote that the chances of the 20-something-year-old successfully establishing a WHA team in New England were, quote, slim and none. After all, founding a professional hockey franchise requires an arena, players, and money. Howard had none of the three. But he had ambition. He wasn't afraid to dream.
To be accused of being a dreamer really isn't such a bad thing, so long as you're willing to work hard, to persevere. This is the story of what it took to make my dreams come true.
Previously on Slim and None.
Keep in mind, November 1971. So we had 10 months to put a team together, get a place to play, raise a couple of million bucks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I realized right then and there that we couldn't, be so loosey-goosey. I mean, we were now, our asses were on the line.
The first order of business, securing proper financial backing.
I figured the easiest way was from one person. And frankly, it was a very easy process. My name's Godfrey Wood.
Then Godfrey Wood was charged with getting us some money. And that got underway very quickly. I mean, I think, within 2 or 3 weeks, we had a meeting with Bob Schmertz.
I mean, really, it was, as I say, we were lucky.
Yeah,
we had put up
there,
nothing.
There you go.
My name is John Coburn, from Needham, Massachusetts, originally. And together with Howard Baldwin, we started the New England Whalers.
But it happened so quick. We had one meeting with him. That was that. We got back in the car. In fact, the back door opened. I almost fell out onto the highway. And Schmertz's lawyer said, don't worry, let him go. We haven't made the deal yet.
Now that they had the funding secured, the focus shifted to finding the right man to lead the Whalers in their inaugural season.
And I suggested to Howard, how about that guy you told me about, Jack Kelly? He said, that's a good idea.
I knew Jack from, as you guys know, the BU days. And so that's why I reached out to Jack. I mean, he's, one of the iconic college hockey coaches is Jack Kelly. Terrific guy, intensely, really competitive, and strict.
He was straightforward. You always knew what he thought. Sort of like Howard. Howard was that way, too.
He would do almost anything to win. That's the only reason you're in pro hockey, to win. My name's Jack Ferrer. I've been in professional hockey 48 years.
Then a 20-something-year-old, Ferreira had no professional experience to date. That didn't matter to his former coach, Jack Kelly, though. Ferreira was known for having a great mind for the game. And so when Kelly was offered the job of coach and GM, Ferreira was one of the first men he called up.
So he contacted me. I was coaching at Brown University at the time. If I was interested to come and join him and do some scouting for him. And I said, sure. You know, I haven't even gone home and said anything to my wife yet, but I said, yeah.
The boys had their money from Schmertz and their leader in Kelly. The pieces were starting to fall into place.
Well, we worked our asses off, but it did come together.
But with opening night quickly approaching, the Whalers were still without a home venue.
I mentioned when I got on that flight going to Florida, we saw Phil David Fine, the attorney who was the person that built Schaefer Stadium for the New England Patriots. So he was branded a very important guy in Boston and a guy that gets things done. And so what he had said to me is, son, if you get the franchise, give me a call and I'll try to help you get a place to play. So he was one of the first calls I made and, went right in to see him.
And Phil David Fine was instrumental in getting us a lease at the Boston Garden because Phil David Fine was a bulldog.
He's one of the key building blocks of the Whalers. And Phil was confident right from the beginning he could get us into Boston Garden, despite the fact there was already two hockey teams playing in the Boston Garden, one in the AHL, one in the NHL.
Getting the Whalers into the Garden would require a Herculean effort. And so Mr. Fine introduced the boys to an associate of his who could assist with the legal work.
And Phil just said, you got to meet this young lawyer. He loves sports and he's a rising star in this firm and he'll handle you. Went and met him. Cap was behind the desk with one of his crazy hairdos. He had a big cigar in his mouth and we bonded instantly.
It's very possible because back in those days, Phil Fine, myself, and one other partner in the firm used to smoke cigars and you could smoke in the office back in those days. My full name is Robert L. Caporel. And I met Howard in Boston when I was practicing law with the firm of Fine and Ambrone. And at the end of the conversation, he asked me if I would be willing to represent him and the team, if you will, the Whalers, which at that point I think was just Howard, John, and Godfrey Wood. And I said, be happy to do it.
Cap was about my age, maybe a year older, and you knew he had a pair of balls and was an absolute right guy to help us with this venture.
I was impressed with his enthusiasm and desire to get this going in Boston. And so we immediately went to work on trying to find a place to play, particularly the Boston Garden.
Now, the Boston Garden in the 70s was a very old building, but it was a mecca. It was a shrine.
The Boston Garden, you know, it was an old building, but it had a lot of character, put it that way.
And at that point, the Bruins played there, the Celtics played there, and the Bruins American Hockey League franchise, the Boston Braves, played there. In addition, they had the circus and they had the ice capades.
Then you had concerts and you had, you know, things like the Beanpot Tournament, which was a big Boston classic. And so there were little to no dates to choose from, is the point I'm trying to make.
If I remember correctly, the Boston Bruins wouldn't let us get dates to play at Boston Garden because they looked at us as unwelcome competition.
In their quest to get into the Garden, Howard and Cap went so far as to prepare legal action against the Bruins. Things never got to that point, though.
And the Bruins were off the hook. When they made dates available, like 21 dates available, they were off the hook antitrust-wise. So we got it Monday nights, sometimes on a Saturday afternoon, Sunday. We got dates that were very undesirable. We just were.
but Howard wanted to play in the Garden. So we took those 20 days.
But we took them. And it worked out okay the first year.
And then the rest of the days were played at what back then was called the Boston Arena, which was the ice arena at Northeastern University.
So we had to get 18 or 19 in the arena. And that was, we had no other choice.
The Boston Arena could have played host to the entirety of the Whalers' home games during their inaugural season, but that would not have sat well with the league.
It was a real shithole. I mean, it just was.
The Boston Arena, which was really a rat trap. Literally, there were rats all over the place.
The arena was so old that Howard's father had played there during his college hockey days.
When I told my father, who was really a top college hockey player at Harvard, class of 33, I mean, he was asked to play, he was asked to try out for the Bruins, but asked to go on the Olympic team. His father wouldn't let him, but he played in the Boston Arena. And I said, you know, I think we're going to play in Boston. He said, oh, my God. He said, that was a dump when I played there at Harvard in 1933. I hope they fix it up. And they did make an effort to fix it up. Old timers will remember the building was not a traditional rink shape. The end zones of the building were shaped like an egg. The puck, if you shot it hard enough, would keep going around and around. It was really built like an egg. And the one thing they did was they modified the arena so it was a regulation 200 by 85. And they made it. They made a bit of an effort for us, and, which we appreciated. But you can't, you know, what is the expression about a pig? You can't put a lipstick on a or whatever. You know what I mean. And the Garden was a dump as well. Who's kidding who? But it was a good dump compared to the Boston Arena.
Well, I played my college career in the Boston Arena, so I knew all that, you know, where all the dump was.
If there were any rooms that could not be called dumpy, it was those brand new locker rooms.
In the arena, they built a locker room. In the Garden, they built a locker room. They didn't build it. We did. We paid for it. We bought... In my time in Boston, we built one locker room in the Boston Arena, two locker rooms in Boston Garden, because after the first year, they moved us to another place, so we had to build a second one in the Boston Garden. And then when we went to Springfield, we had to build two. I mean, we built a lot of locker rooms. Somebody's able to do it.
The arena's locker rooms might have been nice, but the same couldn't be said for the neighborhood of Boston the building was located in.
We were at the Boston Arena, and it was not in the greatest section of town. And Jack was really worried that someone could try to come in and steal their equipment or something.
Though the preference was always to play in Boston, it wasn't always a given that Beantown would be the Whalers' home.
Yeah, I mean... Look, I've always had I love Boston, and I come from a Boston, part New York family. I mean, my mother's side of the family, a member sat in the Senate. Another member was governor of Massachusetts for a number of years. So we had a good profile there, the family did. So I just always loved the city.
And initially, we didn't really focus on Boston. Initially, we focused on Providence because they were actually building a brand new arena in Providence, which is there today, 11,000 seats. So we figured, okay, what could be better? We'll play in Providence.
We knew that if we couldn't get into the Boston Garden for the full season, we'd have to look for other locations. And obviously, Howard wanted to be in New England. And Jack Kelly put us in touch with someone he knew in Providence who claimed could help get the Whalers into the Providence Civic Center.
If the Whalers were to play in the Civic Center, there wouldn't be nearly as much jostling for dates.
There was only one team playing there versus three already at the Boston Garden. So We went down there, and then through a friend of mine that I'd grown up with, he had a cousin who was an attorney there in Providence. This attorney said, "Well, you're going to have a tough time. You know who controls the arena?" And it was the owner of the Rhode Island team, and he was had a bus company.
We right away realized that this was a rigged deck. We were dealing with George Sage, who owned the Bonanza bus lines or something. It was a very corrupt city. It was a very corrupt city. And we tried the legitimate ways to get in there.
Upon hearing about their lack of success, Jack Kelly stepped in.
Jack had a friend who lived in Rhode Island who said he had somebody that he felt could get us into the Providence Civic Center. And Kobe and I said, "Fine, let's meet in Boston." So this guy's name was Bob Reed, and Jim Howe, who was a jeweler. It was amazing. I remember these names came up. But there's a third guy that came with him, and his name itself should have been enough to say, "Stay away." Okay. His name was Ray Badway. That was his name. And you just took one look at him. And if it were today, you wouldn't even go in a room with him. But then what do we know? So he's a fatter version of Joe Pesci. Everything about him stunk to high heaven of crime.
So I went to the next meeting, and a fellow by the name of Ray Badway showed up, and they said that if the team paid, I think it was $15,000, they could get the team into the Providence Civic Center.
So we give them the check like dopes, and of course it doesn't work.
There's talk of mafia. It's all just speculation. And the rumors were that it was fixed. I mean, there was no way we were going to get dates.
This we found out in hindsight. They were going to take that money and pay off some of the members of the Civic Center Commission. I mean, Rhode Island then was kind of the northeast hub of the mafia. And we didn't really know any of this at the time. And frankly, if they had been able to get us in the building, I wouldn't have cared. But they didn't.
The story of the debacle in Providence doesn't end there, though.
Now I have to jump ahead a little, a year ahead, and I get this call from a name you guys may have heard of. He's a rather well-known name, Bud Cianci. But he then was a prosecuting attorney for the city of Providence, and they were doing an investigation into Civic Center corruption.
At this point, the $15,000 was out of sight and out of mind for Howard. The same could not be said of Cianci, though.
And somehow, Buddy Cianci, who was then a prosecutor, got wind of it, and he wanted to interview Howard.
And Buddy called Cap up and said, "Look, I know your client, Howard Baldwin. We were in Hartford by now, or well on our way to Hartford. And I'd like to interview him to find out what he went through." And so Cap said, "Fine." So I drove up to Boston. We met in a back room. I met Bud Cianci. First thing I thought, Bud Cianci, he had the worst hairpiece you've ever seen. It looked like he took a coonskin cap and just slapped it on his head.
And so Howard and I went down. Cianci did the interview.
We met and he asked all these questions, but he didn't ask the right ones. You know, so the meeting ends, we shake hands. He says, "What a pleasure to meet you, Howard," and all that. And I said, "Mr. Cianci, do you mind waiting? I want to talk to my attorney for a minute." And so Cap and I went outside and I said, "Cap, you know, we haven't done anything wrong, but he hasn't asked the right questions. He didn't ever ask about that 15 grand. And I said, "You know, do you think we should tell him?" And we both looked at each other and said, "Yeah, we should definitely tell him."
I told Cianci that I wasn't going to let Howard testify until I knew he had immunity from any criminal prosecution.
You know, in case it would backfire and bite us in the ass. So he did. He went out and he said, Mr. Ciampi, you ought to wait. Howard's got a few things that I think might help you, but I want to make sure I get him immunity.
And Ciampi agreed to give the immunity.
So we got the immunity, and I told him what we did, okay? And his eyes lit up like a Christmas tree because he knew now he had it on these guys. He had these guys, the people that were on the take there, you know, running it and on the Civic Center Commission. And it was a huge scandal. You know, it's kind of a long-winded story. There's actually a final chapter to the story if you want to hear it. So Buddy used that, became mayor, and now there was a trial to go after Ray Badway, Jimmy Howe, Bobby Reed, the three people that were on the take, right? And I'm the key witness. You know, I'm very involved in the WHA at the time, you know, running the league. I was told it would only take a day. Now, so I go up there, first day, Monday, all day they got me on the stand. Next day, all day. And whenever there is a recess, I'm in the hallway, and these guys, Ray Badway's guys, would come up and say, now, Howie, he called me, you don't really want to testify against me, do you? I wouldn't kid you, I was a little bit nervous. They would escort me out. I had to go out through an escort, get in my car. Every time I started it up, I said, is this car going to blow up?
The threats were scary, but nothing scared Howard more than missing that All-Star game.
So Howard went to and testified, and he was told the trial would take one day, but it actually took an entire week.
So now it gets to be Friday, and I got to get on a plane to get to Edmonton for the All-Star. And I said, Cap, what do I do?
I said, you need to write a letter to the judge and to Ciampi explaining why you can't be present the next day of the trial.
Howard didn't have to be told twice. He wrote up the letter and headed off for Edmonton. Several days later, once the weekend's festivities had concluded, he returned to Providence.
And then we show up Tuesday, because now they had me on the stand for 5 days and it looked like another day. Tuesday, I was done in a couple hours. And I'm getting up to leave, relieved. And the judge says, Mr. Bolden, would you sit down, please?
And I realized that the judge is causing Howard to stay, telling everybody to leave, including Ciampi. And I know nothing good is now going to happen.
And the judge then recites why I'm in contempt of court, because I didn't show up on Monday.
I ended up having to represent him in court in Rhode Island when he was being charged by the judge for contempt, not showing up on a trial day.
We prepared the defense, and the judge said, I'm charging you one day of court fees, about $1,000, that you have to pay the court fees and get out of here. That was the end of everything. They dropped the case. I never paid the $1,000. I wasn't going to give them a check for $1,000.
We couldn't get out of there fast enough.
We all heard the wonderful voice of Bob Caporel on this particular episode, and very sadly to report that Cap passed away shortly after this interview. Bob Caporel was as much responsible for the founding of the New England Whalers, soon to be Hartford Whalers, as anybody, including me. He was there right at my side, our side, from day one. When we did the merger, he was legal counsel for the WHA and the lead counsel when we dealt with the NHL. Cap then went on and, with his dear friend and business partner, Randy Vitaha, formerly of the New England Patriots, founded a team in the USFL called the Boston Breakers, who did really well for a couple of years. Then they moved to New Orleans, and then they went by the way of many teams, just like they did in the WHA, into the proverbial dust. But it was a great league. In fact, the league has been resurrected now, and it's starting up in there on Fox this spring. Cap had a very successful firm with Randy called Game Plan, Inc. They did three or four deals for us, Karen and I, the Minnesota deal, the San Jose deal, my exit from the Whalers, and the Dodgers, St. Louis Blues. I mean, he had an extraordinary career. Bottom line, dear, dear friend, fought some great battles, won most of them, if not all of them, and he will be dearly missed. He was a sports treasure. One thing that we're doing now for the future episodes that I think the listeners are really going to enjoy is we're going to expand the scope of the story. It's been pretty focused on the Whalers and some WHA stuff. But now as we get closer to the start of the season, we're gonna have updates on the teams, what's going on in the league. We have the WHA draft coming up. We have the big meeting in Quebec where we fundamentally tell the league that we're not paying the $250, or we're not going to pay $225 of it. And so there's great fun stuff coming up. And I think you'll get a very good picture as we go on our journey on Slim and Non as to what's going on, not only in the WHA, but also in the NHL. And there are some hilarious moments and there are some serious moments. So thank you for being a part of this, and we look forward to continuing to entertain you. This ride will be a ride like you've never had before. If you've been on a roller coaster, you know what that feels like. We'll just take this as an ultimate roller coaster ride on a journey through the world of professional hockey, professional sports, all the ups and downs, trials and tribulations. At the end of the day, when you get off, you will feel very good about it all, and you'll have fun.